This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We are a friend of the people of South Sudan. And so we want to see an end to this conflict, to see an end to their suffering, and to see that they will have a better future.
That's U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan Donald Booth commenting on the situation in South Sudan. Details coming up. Also, more than 160 bodies have been recovered so far from Wednesday's migrant boat tragedy off the coast of Egypt. And the government of Nigeria is hoping again to gain revenue by cracking down on tax cheaters. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the death toll continues to rise in Wednesday's migrant boat tragedy off the coast of Egypt. The AP reports 162 bodies have been recovered so far. The vessel, with hundreds on board, capsized about 12 kilometers from the port city of Rosetta. Survivors say the boat overturned around 5:30 in the morning because it was too crowded. They say it took hours for the Coast Guard to arrive. The first to respond were fishing boats. The exact number of migrant deaths is not known. It is believed many migrants were in the bottom of the vessel in a refrigerated room. The boat may lie 16 meters below the surface of the Mediterranean, so it is not clear whether their bodies will be recovered. The UN Refugee Agency estimates there were 450 people on board at the time of the accident. However, other reports put the figure at 600. Four people said to be crew members have been charged with human trafficking and manslaughter. Gabon's Constitutional Court is expected to rule later this evening on a legal challenge to the re-election of President Ali Bongo. Election officials had announced Mr. Bongo won the August 27th national election by just 2% of the votes, but the court must certify the results. Opposition candidate Jean Ping alleges fraud in Mr. Bongo's home province, where officials claim there was a nearly 100% voter turnout. European Union observers have reported irregularities in those results. Ping is a former African Union Commission chairman and former Bongo ally. Mr. Bongo is a member of the family that has ruled the nation for four decades. In South Sudan, nearly 80 soldiers have been sentenced to either imprisonment or death by firing squad after being convicted of rape, looting, and murder. The charges stem from the fighting that broke out in the capital Juba in early July between the South Sudan Army and forces loyal to former first Vice President Riek Machar. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
SPLA spokesman Brigadier Lul Roy Kwong describes today's sentencing as a day of justice against individuals who violated the SPLA Act of 2009. Kwong says 77 SPLA soldiers, ranging from private to one colonel, were found guilty of various crimes.
The SPLA General Headquarters made good its promise of ensuring that those who committed crimes are punished for their crimes, some to death, some to so many years in prison. I remember two have been sentenced to 14 years, including a captain who was accused of rape.
Kwong says soldiers found guilty of murder will be executed by firing squad. He did not specify when that would happen. Kwong says today's action should make it clear to the rest of the world that the South Sudan government will not tolerate crimes committed by members of the army.
We meant business. We are serious about those who have been tarnishing the name of the SPLA. That the name of the SPLA is a historic name. SPLA is a national army, is an historic movement. The few who have been tarnishing its names have been caught, they have been punished.
The UN reported dozens of incidences of abuse against civilians and international aid workers following the outbreak of fighting in July. Kwong says today's sentencing should serve as a warning to all SPLA soldiers who might think about committing a crime.
The sentences that have been read out here will be a deterrent to those who are still serving the SPLA, that the days of impunity, the days when an SPLA soldier would do bad things, thinking that he would get away with it, are long gone.
Kwong says some of the stolen items have been returned to their owners, including 4 generators belonging to the UN World Food Program. Kwong says some of the soldiers found guilty have been dismissed from the SPLA. Others, he said, were freed after the prosecution failed to provide concrete evidence to back up accusations against them. He did not say how many soldiers were exonerated. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
In mid-December, the conflict in South Sudan will enter its 4th year. Official U.S. efforts to end the violence and bring stability to the world's youngest country continue. To get an update on the current situation, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Ambassador Donald Booth, the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Booth was asked whether former First Vice President Riek Machar remains relevant to the peace process after his flight from Juba in July to escape violence by his political opponents.
We're not taking a position on the leadership of the SPLM in opposition. That's a matter for the SPLM in opposition to decide. Riek Machar has left South Sudan, and he still obviously has many followers, including here in the diaspora in the United States. What we're trying to aim for is that it's not only one person that matters in trying to bring peace to South Sudan. It's bringing all of those who are representing people who have been wronged, who have grievances, who want to have a role in trying to build a country that can live together in peace. And as I said in my testimony before the Congress, we don't believe it is wise for Riek Machar to return to Juba, just from a practical perspective of his safety and how that could be guaranteed. And if he were to go back again with the security forces that he went there with after the peace agreement, we've seen the result of that. And none of us want to see another battle in the streets of Juba. But we also don't think that that's an excuse for Salva Kiir to consolidate power.
You're talking about getting people around the table and all these different stakeholders. How do you do that? I mean, what is sort of the American strategy for how to bring peace and stability to the place, including this idea of sort of sitting around a table, drinking coffee and working it out?
That's really for the South Sudanese to decide how they want to come together to figure this out. All what we're focused on right now is trying to get the Regional Protection Force, which was approved by the UN Security Council last month, to Juba so that there is a stability and a security so that they can begin to think through how they're going to do this.
What is the American interest in this? Why is it such a priority that there be peace there particularly? Why should we care?
Well, the United States was one of the major supporters of the right of South Sudanese to self-determination. We supported them in that effort. We were behind the Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005, which led to the referendum and their vote for independence. And as the world's youngest country, we felt that we should be supporting what we had helped to bring into being by supporting their struggle for self-determination. But more importantly, as I said, we are a friend of the people of South Sudan. And so we want to see an end to this conflict, to see an end to their suffering, and to see that they will have a better future.
In your opinion, how much support does the U.S. plan for an arms embargo actually have? And if it fails, what do you think the plan B might be?
Well, we've been clear that we have proposed an arms embargo in the Resolution 2304, that if the Regional Protection Force is not deployed, if there is obstruction of that, that we would press for the Security Council to consider an arms embargo and perhaps other measures to try to pressure the parties to accept the Regional Protection Force, which we see, again, is key to restoring peace and stability in Juba and opening space for South Sudanese to figure out their future in a peaceful path rather than a violent one.
But if the embargo does not obtain or you don't get that resolution, what then?
If we decide that the Regional Protection Force is being blocked, we will work very hard to make sure that we have the outcomes in the Security Council we're looking for.
You sound hopeful a little bit.
We're always optimistic.
That was Ambassador Donald Booth, the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. You are listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. 148 bodies have been recovered so far from Wednesday's migrant boat tragedy off the coast of Egypt. And in South Sudan, nearly 80 soldiers have been sentenced to either imprisonment or death after being convicted of rape, looting, and murder. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Nigeria's economy has been struggling due to low oil prices and recently fell into a recession. But the government is hoping to gain revenue by cracking down on tax cheaters. According to a Reuters report, authorities have found 700,000 firms that have never paid taxes. But that's not all. Tunde Fowler, chairman of the Federal Inland Reserve Service, says they also expect to find 10 million individuals who have not paid any taxes either. He says tougher enforcement may be combined with a waiver on interest and on penalties for the years 2012 to 2015. Nigeria's recession is made worse by attacks on oil facilities in the Niger Delta, sharply cutting production. The conference for the global conservation body known as CITES opens in Johannesburg, South Africa tomorrow. CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, is expected to decide whether African countries should destroy seized ivory or be allowed to sell it to fund conservation efforts. The question had sparked heated debate on the continent, with some arguing that the future of elephants is at stake. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has the story.
Huge orange flames and plumes of smoke filled the air of Nairobi National Park in April. A sobering image as 105 tons of elephant ivory and 1.35 tons of rhino horn were destroyed. Kenya conducted the event to demonstrate that ivory has no value to anyone except elephants. President Uhuru Kenyatta has pledged his country's support for a complete ban of the ivory trade at the CITES conference. Judy Wahungu, Kenya's cabinet secretary for the Ministry of Environment, Water and Natural Resources, explains further.
So our philosophy has been to burn the entire stockpile, because this is one way of demonstrating to the world that if you offer trade in ivory, we give the misimpression that actually ivory is available. And yet it's this very ivory that's endangering our species.
Tens of thousands of elephants have been killed in recent years for their ivory as a result of strong demand from Asian markets. The recent Great Elephant Census showed a 30% decline in African savanna elephants between 2007 and 2014. About 30 African countries, including Kenya, want a comprehensive ban on all international trade in ivory. Paul Udoto, corporate communications manager for the Kenya Wildlife Service, sums up the Kenyan stance.
Nobody should buy ivory in the wild.
Namibia and Zimbabwe have officially requested through CITES the right to sell their ivory stockpiles. Along with South Africa, these countries say they want to put the proceeds toward conservation efforts. Zimbabwe's finance minister, Patrick Chinamasa, suggested to Parliament in July that there could be other uses for the funds from ivory sales.
We have 9.6 billion worth of ivory in the country, sufficient to write off our debt. So this is the paradox of Africa. Rich Africa, poor Africans. Because the policies are coming from outside and imposed on us. They don't have elephants, but they become members of CITES to ban and stop us from disposing our own assets.
South Africa says destroying ivory makes it scarcer, upping the black market price and driving more poaching. Kenya argues that previous one-time sales have demonstrated the opposite is true, and that opening up trade for some countries puts elephants across the continent at risk. Philip Maruthi, Vice President of Species Conservation at the African Wildlife Foundation, agrees with Kenya's position.
It is very, very hard to distinguish between legal and illegal ivory. And that means that having a legal supply of ivory in the market perpetuates the killing. And so the cycle continues, where you have trade, you have benefits going to a few kingpins, you deny livelihoods to communities, and the populations continue to suffer.
Although elephants are the top issue for Africa at the CITES talks, trade restrictions and allowances for close to 500 other species will also be on the table. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Violent domestic conflict had closed many schools in northern Mali for 2 years, but next week, about 200,000 children are prepared to go back to school. Whether those young students stay in class depends on whether they have something to eat in a country with chronically high malnutrition rate. The World Food Program says it can solve that problem, especially for girls, but there is no money to fund their school nutrition program. Adele Sarkozy is a spokesperson in Geneva for WFP's West and Central Africa program. She talked to VOA's David Arnold about the Mali food program that is in jeopardy.
It's a very delicate, a very difficult situation. We know that school meals have played an important role in Mali. Mali is a country that has been affected by conflict since 2012. Parts of the country, especially in the northern part of the country, is still affected by conflict. And we know that the school meals have played an important role in encouraging parents to send their children back to school when these schools reopened only last year. So it's very disheartening to see that we are no longer able to support these children. We have spoken to parents, to teachers, and they are saying that if the school meals are not provided in the schools, then the children are at risk of dropping out of school, especially girls. We are also providing their families with what we call take-home food rations. These are sort of incentives for the parents to send their girls to school. If they are no longer receiving these incentives, it's likely for them to stop their girls from going to school. We also know that often the school meals are the only nutritious meal a child receives a day.
Does that mean that you deliver the food to them in the schools and they take the food home?
It's two things. We are providing the meals in the school, the lunch, to all the children. And then in addition to this, as an incentive to the poorest families and the families who have girls, we are also providing take-home food rations. So this is an additional support.
Why is it that girls are the focus of this program?
It's important to focus on the girls because we know that across the region and in many parts of the world, girls are the ones who are affected the most in terms of parents prioritizing the boys in the family to attend school. Providing these incentives to their families, we are helping UNICEF and other organizations and the government, of course, to close this gender gap to girls and to their families.
Last year, there were 200,000 who were receiving this program.
There were exactly 170,000 children, and half of them were girls.
In terms of the geography of Mali, where are most of the problems that exist for these children?
A conflict-like situation in the northern part of the country. This is where the children, as a consequence, are the most affected. But across Mali, we are talking about a context where more than a quarter of the population, more than 3 million people, suffer from food insecurity. Nearly half a million people suffer from what we call severe food insecurity, basically not having enough food to lead a healthy life. Also, it's important to know that in Mali, we are talking about a country that is suffering from chronic malnutrition. So even before the conflict in 2012, even in peaceful years, malnutrition rates in Mali are among the highest in the world. And the school meals obviously play an important role to tackle this chronic malnutrition situation in Mali. So unfortunately, this year we are at risk on a number of fronts in Mali because of lack of funding, basically. And it's not just Mali. We are working in a region where that it's constantly affected by increasing conflict. And this it's putting us in a difficult position because the funding is basically shrinking. So we focus more on emergencies at the risk of neglecting some of the longer-term development programs, such as the school meals. And Mali is a good example.
That was Adele Sarkozy of the World Food Programme from Geneva. She spoke with VOA's David Arnold. Researchers are closer to developing a vaccine against the Zika virus. An experimental vaccine uses DNA technology to trigger an immune response against Zika. The virus can cause birth defects if pregnant women become infected. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The experimental DNA injection being worked on at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, or NIH, outside of Washington, is a newer generation of vaccine. A DNA vaccine works much differently than regular vaccines that use live, weakened, or dead virus to stimulate an immune response in the body. DNA vaccines are different in those that use copies of genetic material from a pathogen. This DNA is introduced into cells in the lab, which then replicate proteins from the virus but don't cause disease. When those cells are introduced into the body, Barney Graham, deputy director of the Vaccine Research Center at the NIH, says the synthetic DNA fragments mimic the disease-causing pathogen.
What we want is to present the outer surface of the virus to the immune system so that it can recognize that with antibodies and make more of those antibodies so that if you see the real virus, those antibodies can block it from infecting.
So far, no DNA vaccines are approved for human use in the United States, but researchers are trying. Early clinical trials of DNA vaccines are underway, but Graham's lab is trying to establish an effective dose for full protection. In a study published in the journal Science, investigators found that 17 of the 18 rhesus macaques that got two doses of the experimental DNA vaccine were completely protected from the disease. Six monkeys that received a single weaker dose became infected with Zika, but had less of the virus in their system than the control group of animals that received no treatment. There is a big advantage with this type of vaccine, according to Graham.
Because it's become a standard platform technology that we can manufacture ourselves and move it through the system very quickly, even through the regulatory process, and get it into trials quickly, this is the rapid response, hoping to get into the field trials quickly enough before the epidemic wanes that we can actually get an answer. Does this vaccine work? If it does work, what is the antibody response level needed to protect people?
Graham says the DNA approach has become standard in attempting to develop vaccines for other diseases, including Ebola, West Nile virus, SARS, influenza, and HIV. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.